I know what keeps you staying alive, but I know I rely on coffee to keep me strutting. And when it comes to coffee, if I can't have spark plug, I don't want nobody, baby. And that's because spark plug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that they deliver this excellent coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. You will taste the difference, and I ain't jive talking. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Get out your silk and your linens, or your fruit if you live in England, because this podcast marks our fourth anniversary! We started the Top 100 Project on March 25th, 2013, so we're just days away from reaching the four-year milestone. And this is episode number 200!
That's fireworks! Bam!
High five again!
Bam!
Yay, the dogs like it too!
Happy anniversary, baby! This is a surprise! I don't keep count. He does all of this, so he surprised me.
Told you I would tell you when it came up. Now, just to be clear, not all of the podcasts have been movie reviews. We did the intro, the wrap-up to the Top Nerd Project in both cases, the Oscar shows, two of those, plus we split Citizen Kane into two parts. But this is, in fact, the 200th entry of ours you can find on iTunes or our website. So thanks to you all for helping us get this far. By the way, before we go any further, I should warn you that we are spoiling fools, also dancing fools, in these podcasts. I'm the so weird host, Ryan Ellis, and my dancing queen co-host is my wife, Bev.
That's me.
All right, then, the coming attraction trivia for this episode, number 200. Saturday Night Fever is the second best-selling movie soundtrack album of all time. What's number one, and which other John Travolta movie was in the top 10?
Well, I definitely knew the second part of this question. Grease is the obvious answer.
Correct.
Honestly, when you first asked me the question, I was like, I bet Grease is the answer to number one. But no, I never would have guessed this. It's The Bodyguard. Mm-hmm.
In all cases, the movies are very old. Bodyguard's 25 years old. Saturday Night Fever is 40 years old. And Grease is 39 years old. All right, the next one on our project's 55th film, Saturday Night Fever, was absolutely nominated for the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Obviously, it didn't make it either time. Paramount Pictures released The Flicker Show in December 1977. This was a monster hit. Bev, explain the hit for people who might have forgotten what it's about with the skinny.
John Travolta is Tony Manero, a 19-year-old Italian Brooklyn kid with a crummy job and an even crummier home life. But all that is forgotten when he hits the disco, where his dancing skills set him apart and help him escape one Saturday night at a time. His moves gain him the admiration of everyone, except the object of his affection and fellow great dancer, Karen Lynn Gorney's Stephanie. So he tries to change her mind by pairing up with her to win a dance contest. And you know, that skinny makes it sound like a pretty innocent G-rated movie, mm-hmm. which it's not.
A lot of people are misled about what this movie's actually about. It's a lot deeper and darker than they think. But in a nutshell, paint salesman wins rigged dance contest. Because he does indeed win with his, as they say online, subpar dance partner. Stephanie, well, the actress Karen Lynn Gorney wasn't as good as John Travolta, but then how many people really are?
Well, she's definitely not good enough to rationalize that as a plot point, that she's such a good dancer that she, you know, wins him with her moves. But all the dancing, while it's good, it's kind of absurd to go back to the 70s and watch a dance movie that's pre-Michael Jackson. Dance has gone so far, and the bar's been raised so much higher since then.
Or even post-Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire. Quite a few years after those guys, granted. But the ultimate movie musicals where those guys were incredible dancers, and Travolta is in their class. If he'd been around in the 50s or the 40s or 30s, he would have been as good or better than those guys, I think.
Yeah, and I think there's probably better dancing in the movie Grease than there is in this movie. Maybe it's intentional, where he's definitely a good enough dancer. He's really fun to watch. But then, of course, they save the big one for the end. The best dancers in the movie are by far the Puerto Rican
dancers competing
against them. Yeah, and it's, like, important. The audience knows right away. There's no question. No matter
so
how much you're rooting for him,
he is not in
you
denial.
Have to acknowledge that
everyone else's friends and Stephanie are in denial. Yeah, we won. He knows they didn't win. I'm going to quote him here so it would be offensive, but this is what he says. The very offensive movie. A lot of bad words are thrown around, including a lot of racial slurs. But he says, if the Spics are good, they deserve it. So it's sort of a liberated stance.
And he knows the judges are racist. It's not that it was rigged just because they had some stake in Tony winning. It was rigged because they wanted the white couple to win.
Also Italian, because I'm sure that they also were Italian. Mm. Or the odds were good, at least, that they were Italian in that area.
Not that they really address it in this movie, but disco was definitely not started by white people. It was started in gay, black, and Puerto Rican clubs in, I think it was in New York, right?
Well, you know one thing about this, I always thought that they were going to Manhattan to go to the 2001 Odyssey. There's one of the influences. Stanley Kubrick, yet again. So many filmmakers have done that. We talked about it in Raising Arizona not long ago, where the POE, Purity of Essence thing, is in the bathroom. Well, here you got 2001 Odyssey. It has nothing to do with that movie other than that one moment. What? You're looking at me.
Oh, because it was a real club. There was a real club called 2001 Odyssey.
Okay, well,
because the movie was based
on
an article.
In Brooklyn.
Yes.
Because I always thought, when I've seen this movie a couple of times now, I guess I never paid that much attention to it, this one detail at least, that I thought they're going to Manhattan, and that's the idea. They're going across the bridge to a whole new world, but no, it's in their actual neighborhood, or at least nearby their neighborhood, and the real fantasy is a place they never really get to at all in the movie, Manhattan. I guess I wasn't paying close enough attention to realize that they weren't actually going there. That would have been better, I think, if they had gone to Manhattan to go to this dance club, but I guess they had to find one they could actually use.
Yeah, not only is it all in Brooklyn, I think they say at one point when they're talking about the dance contest that he doesn't think he can win because there's going to be dancers coming from Manhattan, implying mm-hmm. that there are disco clubs in Manhattan that they just don't feel like they're good enough to go to. They want to be the big fish in this little pond.
Right, sure.
But not only are they not in Manhattan, that bridge apparently isn't even the Brooklyn Bridge.
It's the Verrazano
Narrow Bridge or something. Staten Island. That's his fantasy, to go to Staten Island. That's
and he knows
like,
everything about that bridge, too.
Yeah, yeah, but he fetishizes
bridge
it.
Expert.
They all do. They have that ritual of going there and goofing around on it all the time. When you see a movie set in New York in any way, and especially Brooklyn, and they are looking at a bridge, you just kind of assume it's the Brooklyn Bridge. I don't know on site Brooklyn Bridge and all of its features.
Also a movie that's all about dreams and trying to be better than you are, trying to aspire to something more than you are, that you're going to go to Manhattan, because sure, you can have a great life in Brooklyn or Staten Island or the Bronx or Queens, but if you really want to hit big dreams like he has, you're going to go to the big Manhattan Island to achieve those big dreams. So that's why I guess I made that mistake.
Yeah, and that's where Stephanie is going, and mm-hmm. we do see them in Manhattan. That, to her, is making it, and she has to make some pretty serious compromises in order for that to happen.
Right, so that's the one time it goes over to Manhattan. Okay, so let's get back a little bit to the numbers before we get into the main body. We've already talked a lot about the movie, but Rotten Tomatoes numbers, big skew here. 86% of critics liked it, 38 fresh, only 6 rotten, but 71% of audiences. Wow, that's barely a passing grade. In fact, on Rotten Tomatoes, is that a passing grade? It may not be for the audiences. It's right on the fringes of it, at the very least. When you talk about critical numbers, the most famous critic that ever liked this movie, Gene Siskel, one of his favorites, may not be his absolute favorite, but one of for sure. It's been said he bought the suit for a lot of money. I guess he just latched on this movie for all kinds of reasons you can't explain. I like movies that people will be surprised I like as much as he supposedly liked this one, but that's one of the big legends of this film, that Gene Siskel was one of its all-time fans. The movie was fifth at the 1977 U.S. box office. Of course, Star Wars was number one by 3 landslides. And Saturday Night Fever is still 170th on Box Office Mojo's top 200 adjusted for inflation, and it's made $350 million adjusted. So that is a pretty fair-sized hit. We haven't talked about the Box Office Mojo numbers adjusting for inflation that much in recent years. We haven't really picked movies that were those kinds of monster hits, but here's one that was. The movie's episodic. There's no real plot. It's Scorsese-esque in that way, also set in New York, of course. With the language, there's a lot of bad language in this film, surprising amount of it, and also even the look of it. Maybe not quite Scorsese-esque, John Badham's no Scorsese, but is similar enough to that, the look, the style, the ideas, and as I said, the plotlessness of it.
Yeah, I went into the movie expecting something like Rocky, but instead the tone felt far more like Taxi Driver to me.
Yeah, well, this rough subject matter, and I told you that weeks ago it was going to be like that. The swearing, the sexism, the racism, the sex scenes, rape.
Mm.
Death, a guy who not quite is killing himself, but might as well be.
I think they even say, oh, there's more than one way to kill yourself, or there's ways of killing yourself without killing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he wants to die, and he wants them to feel responsible for it.
And Bobby C., who's Barry Miller, there's a lot of cries for help in this film. They laid it on a little bit too thick, maybe, But it's a nice touch that his friends are ignoring him, the defrocked priest, well, he's defrocking himself. Even he ignores this guy's cries for help. Father, what do I do about my girlfriend who I should marry and he's going to have a kid? What do I do? What do I do? I'm watching my brother. Fuck off.
He's like, I'm not a priest anymore. Leave me alone. And when he's on the bridge risking his life, he's not saying, what am I going to do about my girlfriend? My life is ruined because I knocked this woman up that I don't want to marry. He's saying, Tony, why didn't you call me? Mm-hmm. That's his lament.
And Tony finally gets what's going on, but it's too late because he does fall. So not suicidal in a literal sense, but it's one of those accidental on purpose type deaths.
I would call it suicidal.
Well, he wasn't trying to do it as much as you might see in other movies or in reality. We talked about blatant racism, and it really is in this movie. There's no doubt about that. But it does fit these characters that they would speak this way. We talked about in LA Confidential not that long ago. We covered that back in February. There are no N-words, and that's the one thing that movie doesn't get authentically right, because these guys would definitely have thrown around a lot of racial slurs, and certainly against the Mexicans, but of course there's also the black guys. They wouldn't be calling them Negroes. They would have been calling them the other word, of course, and they would have been saying probably even worse than that. But this movie does go there, and that may have surprised you too. It must have surprised you too.
Well, it was a movie in the 70s, actually. I guess it surprised me. Especially because it's quite near the beginning of the film and you're still kind of trying to parse out what you're watching, too. So, again, like I said, I was expecting Rocky and I was expecting a much sweeter movie than I got.
Well, you know the thing I think that sets the tone for this film is the beginning. And not every movie does this as effectively as this one does. The most famous part of this movie, well, there's two things. One is the point and the white suit, which he never does, as I recall, in the dance scene. The famous bang with the pointing finger during the number at the end with the white suit. He doesn't really do that. He does it earlier with different clothes on. But the other famous part is the beginning with the staying alive,
the strut.
And he's strutting, but the thing that people forget is he's doing it with a paint can because he is going from one paint store back to his hardware store. He's working.
Yeah.
And I like the touch, too, when he tries to hit on the girl, she rebuffs him, and he does that whole ball grab thing. And later on, he gets his ass grabbed by Fran Drescher, too, for that matter. But in that beginning, the authentic touch of this guy isn't just walking down the street just doing nothing. There's a purpose to this. He's actually on the job, but he's delaying. He even goes to get pizza. Yeah. They also forget that in the end sequence, when he's dancing with Stephanie, he's all cut up and bruised for the fact that his friends and himself got into this big brawl with these other guys a couple of days before. The Barracudas, right. So his face has a bandage on it and some big-time bruises. And if you look at the DVD case, the cover of it has him doing the point in the white suit. But you don't see those bandages and you don't see those bruises. But if you open it up, you see him sitting on the subway, still in the suit, because it's after the night's over. He's going to Stephanie's place at the very end of the film. And he does have the bandage and he does have the bruises.
But isn't that from the original promotion material? That was just how they...
I hearken back to two DVDs that we own that I always think about, Monsters Ball and My Left Foot. Monsters Ball, Halle Berry for Halle Berry looks like crap, a lot of that film. And Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot looks nothing like Mr. Movie Star. But on the cover of both movies, they're smiling, their hair is styled, they look like they came straight from a promotional shoot.
Yeah.
So maybe it's the same deal with this movie. Now when we see all the scenes in the dance club, considering how much Tony's worshipped, he should be swimming in sex. And yet, apart from an attempted rape on Stephanie at the end of the film, and then some sex implications with Annette, he never seems to get anywhere with anybody. Oh, Fran Drescher grabs his ass. He probably could have banged her.
But he doesn't.
So there's a guy who probably should be fucking a woman every single Saturday night and doesn't really ever seem to.
He has this undeniable sexual charisma, but he doesn't seem to care about sex. He cares about dancing. And he's interested in Stephanie, but even when he tries to rape her, it's not motivated by lust at all. It's motivated by his own frustrations at the injustice of the dance. He kind of like loses his faith in that contest.
Because he's very angry about it.
Yes. Because they weren't the best dancers, and he's probably mad at himself for that too. And mad at her because she's also, a rape victim. No, she's not a tease. Okay. She says no every single time.
She's not
batting her eyelashes at him. If she's a tease because she spends time with him, when he's insisting over and over again that I'm not going to hit on you, I just want a dance partner, just spend time with me, just be my friend, she won't even let him walk her home. That's definitely not a tease.
Yeah, she's not a tease.
So it's not lust that motivates him, it's just anger. He's angry at the world. He's angry at her because she's also kind of mean to him. Mm. Like his mother. She talks to him the way his mother does. She calls him a loser right to his face. She's annoying. She doesn't have the most winning personality. She's always name-dropping all the celebrities she works with. I don't think she's a bad person. I think actually by the end of the movie, she has her own little redemption as well. But it wasn't lust. Every sex scene in this movie is horrible. This movie has a terrible image of sex, and it was made in the late 70s. There was definitely an aftermath of the free love of the 60s. All the hippies did their thing, and this was the next generation to come up, always believing free love was their birthright, I suppose. And whether this was actually what was going on or not, whether the world was ever like this, because I don't ever remember an age of mine where people ever behaved like this.
We grew up in the age of AIDS, so hell no.
Yeah, there's that too. There was a paranoia, but even like the most promiscuous woman I ever knew in my whole life, and I've known my share of different kinds
almost
of people.
Almost 40 years.
Oh, yeah, like I'm pretty old, first of all, and I've always lived like a pretty liberal life. I've never known anyone remotely like, say, Annette, who seems to want to desperately sleep with him, despite his obvious contempt that he seems to be shoving in her face every chance he gets.
Offers the handful of condoms, which made me think, why aren't they using condoms anyway?
I know, seriously.
Why does she have to offer him three in her hand?
He assumes she's on the pill, which is, again, is like a very post-free love era thing. Then he asks her, are you fixed? Are you on the pill? And when she says no, he's like, we're not having sex then, because I don't want to knock you up.
Well, he's an Italian person, so of course he would have to marry her if he did knock her up.
Just like poor Bobby C.
Right. This may not be sex, but one of the strange touches in the film, which is probably authentic, but in one of the back rooms of the 2001 Odyssey Club, is the half-naked woman dancing. We see her twice doing this. It just seems odd to me. It's almost like this is a strip club in the back of a regular old disco club.
Yeah, maybe this is New York of the 70s that this kind of stuff was permitted to happen. Now there's so many bylaws everywhere that would never happen.
And no one seems to even really notice her because they don't seem to care because, as you say, the movie's not about sex. The sex that men try to take in this film or the women try to offer in this film is not about love or even really lust. It's more about, let's do this, why the hell not, or the rape scenes of Annette. And even that's not rape in the beginning. The first guy, I forget the names of all the friends now, but the one that fucks her, she's willing to bang them all. They make that pretty
laughing,
clear.
She's laughing, she seems to be having a good time.
But then when the other guy goes back there, it's my turn, and she doesn't want it. And we know now, we really should have known then, especially when a girl's crying, you should have known then. If she decides to change her mind, you should be pulling away, dude, because you shouldn't be making somebody do something she doesn't want to do.
I was actually relieved to find that when I was reading vintage reviews that came out in the 70s, everyone just straight up referred to that as rape. Nobody was parsing their words about it, saying, oh, an almost rape, a borderline rape. I mean, you could say the Stephanie rape attempt is like a borderline rape, but they fully admitted that Annette was not consenting to that.
With the second guy more so than the first guy.
Although she's blasted. She's totally hammered. She's apparently taking speed. I didn't catch that.
Both drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
And probably thinking this leads to I eventually get to fuck Tony that night, but he has nothing but contempt for her and everybody in the car, and probably for himself as much as anybody else in that car.
Yeah, that's a good point. He hates himself. Like, he hates his life. He doesn't seem to like his friends very much.
Especially at the end. He's tossed them aside.
Yeah, now, because maybe they're bad people, too.
And maybe he'll go back to being friends with them, but I don't know. The movie suggests that he's going to try to turn a new leaf. And that's probably why this movie was nominated for the Top 100 Cheers. Because not only does he have the aspirations of being the great dancer, but even at the end, and maybe that's why the Cheers nomination happened more than anything, is that he goes to Stephanie, is on the subway all night long. It's implied he has a long subway ride. We've been to New York. I don't know why it's so long.
I actually looked up where they would have lived in Brooklyn, because you can find where the club was. So I'm just inferring that that's where they lived. And it was quite farther. It wasn't Bed-Stuy. It wasn't Williamsburg. It was way closer to Staten Island than it was to Manhattan. Okay. Not that you'd be on the subway all night still, but I guess it's implied he's sitting on the subway thinking.
Okay, all right. And also the investigation of the Bobby C. suicide accident, whatever you want to call it, might have taken them till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning as well. But when he goes to Stephanie at the end of the film and they have this moment where they can actually say they'll be friends, although she kisses him right after that, but it's not a romantic kiss. It's a kiss of friendship. It does have that hopeful ending. And then there is the sequel, Staying Alive, which I haven't seen in a long time. Don't remember anything about it. I know he got to be in incredible shape. He was in good shape in this film. Travolta's always battled weight in his entire life, but in Staying Alive, he was a Sylvester Stallone rock-like figure, and Stallone actually directed Staying Alive.
Interesting, that's right, too. He did, yeah.
Two Italian-American icons of the 70s and the early 80s. I talked about authenticity, another authentic touch I like so much. Tony wears the red shirt and leather jacket combo more than once in this film.
Oh, yeah.
I love that, because look at TV shows. I don't want to hack on Friends, a New York show, though. They never wore the same clothes twice, did they? Ever once?
No.
But here's a guy who doesn't have very much money, who has to put a shirt down on a layaway, puts down $5 to buy it later. But it's an inconsistent touch that they go to the club, I guess it's that same night or within a few days of it at least, and then he has money to drink, and he has money to smoke.
Yeah, I know, noticed that. He's like bugging his boss to pay him on Friday instead of Monday. But yeah, where does he get the money to just go to the club? Although, do we see him spend that much money at the club? He gets in.
No, but he buys drinks.
Usher him. Okay, yeah, there you go. He does.
Would have been cheaper in the 70s, but it still costs something to drink and smoke. And it's not like he's putting $25 or $30 down for that shirt. He's putting down $5.
Maybe it was that he was planning ahead. If I buy the shirt out right now, I won't have any money to party. So I have to put money down to buy it later so that I'll have enough money to party tonight. Right.
But speaking of shirts, one of the other great scenes in the film doesn't get talked about nearly enough because it's both funny and also, I think, I wasn't alive in the, well, I was three back then, and I had nothing to do with the disco era, but it feels so authentic to me, especially in a European-American community or household, where he wears the towel over the shirt so he doesn't get any food on it, and then the father slugs him a couple of different times in the back of the head. He hits it. He hits my hair. That's just a great line. But everybody gets slugged at the table in that scene. The father hits Tony. The mother hits the father. Everyone seems to get hit in that scene. And then, of course, the father objects. You never hit me before. But the father's out of work, and the mother seems to be more liberated. So it's not a movie you think about women's lib, but in that one moment, I suppose, the mother at least is liberated.
Liberated to
hit.
Cruelly hit her husband.
Which is not okay, but I just mean that you didn't see that kind of thing in the European-American communities very often. From what I've ever seen in movies and what I've ever heard in reality, the man was the boss, and here's a situation where the woman's becoming the boss. And yes, Tony, who just wants to go out and have a good time, he's been working on his hair all this time, has the battle with his father. He is bitching about his hair getting slugged. And we see later on, you fucking asshole, he says to him. You wouldn't have seen that in the 50s, in movies that are set in New York, of course. Yeah. But you also get the authentic touch of this guy with Italian-Americans on the wall. What was in Do the Right Thing? Italian-Americans in the pizzeria wall! No black people, right? That's the whole big reason why the pizzeria gets burned down and everything happens at the end. Well, that's actually the excuse, I should say. There's bigger reasons for why that happens, but that's the excuse for why Buggin' Out and Radio Raheem start the big brawl. Well, they don't start it, but anyway, why that all happens. But if you look at Tony's wall, you've got Al Pacino and Serpico, which was produced by this producer, and you've got Rocky, and you've got Bruce Lee. So not an Italian guy, but it did remind me of that whole thing of Italian-Americans only on the wall.
Also, machismo, very Italian-American thing. But machismo is such a big part of this movie. It plays into one of the biggest themes of the movie, which is outward appearance. The movie's all about the millions of ways we fuss about our projection to the world. Tony cares about his look, his hair, and definitely his machismo. Tony's mom cares deeply about having a priest for his son, so much so that she apparently coerced her son into doing it, disregarding what he would have wanted and presumably robbing him of all those years and probably damaging her relationship with him. Dad cares about looking tough in front of his kids and maintaining that machismo position. Stephanie cares about bragging about celebrities she's met and her intentions to move to Manhattan. You know, I love that quick line that says so much when she's with her, I guess, boyfriend, the guy who's helping put her up in Manhattan, and she's called something super, and he says, I told you not to say super. No one says super anymore. This policing of the way she is, it's all phony, it's artifice, it's transparent, and it's exhausting. The whole movie keeps showing us over and over how performative ego is.
So we have another example of actors acting. Everyone's pretending to be something they're not, or pretending to be something better than they really are. The father is maybe the best example of all of that, because he's trying to be the tough guy, and maybe he's been a tough guy, but that's been a front, I guess, all along, because if his wife can slap him around and his son can call him a fucking asshole and nothing happens from that, and of course it shouldn't, but that's the way things would have been in the 70s and probably into the 80s and maybe even to now in some households. If you dared to talk back, or if you dared to cuff the father, he wouldn't get away with that.
I wish that the movie had spent more time with the character of the brother Frank, because it seems like he just kind of gets dropped.
It's a weird plot device.
He is this really wonderful contrarian example to what everybody's doing, because he tried to live that life. We never learn exactly what happened or why he left the priesthood, but for whatever reason, he couldn't hack it anymore. He finally admitted that he never wanted to be a priest. But what he comes back as when he returns to the family is this blank slate authentic version of himself, where he's finally decided he doesn't care what anybody thinks, but now he's curious about what kind of person he will be when he's already disappointed his family and he only has himself to please. It's like a really interesting contrary to what Tony's doing. And
almost everybody else.
Yeah, everybody else in the film. But you can see he could really have a lot of influence on Tony. Tony respects him and he loves him.
Well, maybe that's why, because he has a nice relationship with him. That's the best part of the Frank character. It is a plot device that I don't think works as well as it could. But maybe we're finding a way that it does work now that we say this now, because yeah, they are close as brothers in the few scenes they have together. And then Frank sees him dance and says, you have a real gift. You're great at this. So when Tony comes to the realization at the end of the film, which of course is going to be something that's developed longer than just in one night, when Bobby C. dies and he and Stephanie win but don't really win, it's an accumulation of a lot of things. So maybe the Frank influence from before is one of the reasons why he rides all the way to Stephanie's place in the morning and says, I'm going to be something better. I need to be something better, and I will be something better. I'll be something different than what I am, just like he was something different than he was. He never actually brings up his brother, but he doesn't need to.
And his brother's existence opens up this world of possibilities to him, of a world where what people think doesn't necessarily matter. And it makes you wonder, what would Tony be if he didn't grow up in this context, which he thrives in. He obviously does well. He's a very charismatic guy, but he doesn't seem to use his charisma for anything useful. The only thing that seems to make him happy, the only thing he has passion for, is dancing. And yet, the dancing is a means with no end, because disco dancing is never going to get him anywhere. It's not going to get him to Manhattan. Yeah, it's not going to get him to Staten Island. He even admits to himself that, you know, his dream is to open up his own paint store. That's the most ambitious thing he can imagine.
Okay, now here's a bit of a sidebar, but I've talked about this with you and a friend now. I never even thought of this until recently, but I have issues with paint.
Oh, yeah, we talked about this.
I never thought of this until we were watching Saturday Night Fever, I guess. But of all the things that we have done as a species on this planet to pollute the planet, oil's been bad, natural gas has been bad for the planet, the things we've done, it's all true, but we've had use for that. Oil is used in so many things we do. Natural gas is useful. Paint is entirely cosmetic. Am I glad you painted this house when we first moved in here? There was a disaster area when we moved into this house. And I was cleaning the outside and you had the inside. Of course I'm glad. You did a great job with it. But it's unnecessary, and the fact there's so much waste that comes from paint, the quadrazillions of gallons of paint that have been washed away into sinks and toilets probably, and God knows where else, in the sewers. We've been a very pollutive species. Pollutive is probably not even a word. But God knows, the paint part of our pollutive species is the most unnecessary thing. But that's what this guy is. I mean, yeah, he works in a hardware store, but we see him carrying the paint. I'm going to give you a deal on this paint, yeah, Mrs. whatever her name is. It looks like that's where his future could be, as somebody who actually runs a paint store. Now, nothing to do with this film, I know, but it just seems like of all the things that we've ever done as a species, man, that's something we could have just never had, and it would have been a lot better for everything.
But then all of our walls would be the same color, Ryan, you fool. Of course there's a use to paint. It makes our house pretty. I'm going to reach out right now to anyone who's listening, if you're like a contractor, if you know anything about building, I'm sure there's got to be some practical reason for paint that we'd actually need it in our house to, I don't know, hold the drywall up or something. Please rationalize paint for me. Because there's no way I'm going to live without it.
I'm not saying I want to either. I'm just saying that that's one of the most unnecessary things we've ever done as a species. And yet, here's a character in a film, and an unusual touch, too. A guy works in a hardware store, and here's a guy who specifically is a paint expert. But back to the themes of the movie, back to the ending. Now, so he wears the white suit, which everyone knows from this film. And that would have been a black suit if Travolta had it his way, but then he was told by somebody, that wouldn't have stood out. You would have blended into the background, which is not really true. Pretty good DVD, by the way. It pops quite a bit. Of course he doesn't blend into the background. You can see him quite nicely, and he would have even had a black suit on. But the white suit is so iconic. Maybe because it's such a weird-looking thing. It looks like he's, hey, Frank Jr., a little bit religious wearing a white suit, as opposed to it being a black bad man, badass suit.
It also looks a little bit flamboyant, which is very disco, which came from the gay scene, so that could be part of that. Not that I think there's any insinuation that Tony is a gay character, flamboyant. For a dancer, I mean, you think that that could be a possibility, but it's not. Also, Travolta struggled with his weight, but he was in tip-top shape in this
movie. At this point, sure.
He can wear the hell out of that suit. Like, not a lot of people could wear that suit that's that tight. That shirt is just painted on him. Mm. And the pants, too, of course, famously. Good for them for showing it off for us.
Well, at that point, he was still very young. Of course he could wear it then. Apparently, when Siskel bought the suit, Roger Ebert asked him if he tried it on, and Siskel said it was a little tight. And Siskel wasn't exactly a big man himself. No, he was taller, I think, maybe than Travolta, but he was very thin. But that just goes to show how in shape Travolta was, who lost a lot of weight to play the role. But I'm just saying that if you watch his career, this is not a guy who was always a little dude in tip-top shape, like some of them are now, who aren't little, actually, but always in tip-top shape. We've talked about that before in other podcasts. Modern actors, guys who have no reason to look like they do, maybe apart from Philip Seymour Hoffman in his prime, are just ripped like a bodybuilder. Yes. And Travolta for 1977 was pretty ripped. Not like a bodybuilder, but nevertheless. So how about the ending, though, with him and Stephanie in her place? this movie that's known for the dance scenes, but it's like Rocky. It's not really about the dancing. Rocky's not really about boxing. It's about other things. This one ends with that quiet scene of revelation and reflection. Can men and women really be friends? When Harry met Sally, yes, the question is out there.
Yeah, well, Harry never tried to rape Sally. I don't want to dwell on it too much because I think the movie actually handles it surprisingly well for a movie that was made in the 70s, especially. You know, when they show Annette's rape, they show her in shock afterwards. She tries to run away from them. There's an aftermath to it. I like how Tony is this example of a quote-unquote normal guy, a good guy, our protagonist, who still seems to be pretty capable of committing this terrible crime. We prefer to think of the crime of rape and rape as monsters, never people that we could personally like and even look up to. Because you do, you like Tony, flaws and all. They make sure to make it clear he's the monster here who's doing wrong. He even realizes himself and stops as soon as she puts up enough of a fight
to derail him.
Yeah, rape. She kicks him in the nuts, I think, and it just kind of wakes him up and snaps him out of it. She's the one person other than his brother in the movie that he seems to have any connection with, even though she's mean like his mom, but she's not as bad as his mom either. It's almost like his mom probably started off somebody like Stephanie and then got lured in by some sexy guy who was probably a good dancer, lured into a marriage that wound up ruining her life. Because it's hard to be a woman watching the last act of this film and these back-to-back rapes that seem pretty real, seem maybe a little too real to just walk away from. And then I'm so glad everything worked out for Tony. Like, I struggle to understand why Stephanie would have let him in her house at the end of the movie, aside from the fact that the movie was made in the 70s is probably the best answer.
Those rapes are not the Melfi rapes, is what we always call it, because the infamous rape in The Sopranos.
Yes,
when the Dr. stranger Melfi rape. Is raped by somebody in a stairwell violently. You say, oh, rape's violent, but it isn't always violent. A lot of times, in fact, generally, it probably comes down to somebody you know, but they're not doing it with a knife to your throat or a gun at your head.
Well, the Annette rape is a great example of that. She's not really fighting back, but she's crying. She's very clearly upset and doesn't want to do that.
But she also had implied or even said she would do all of them earlier. So the guy's doing what has been told is going to happen in the first place. But then when she's crying, why is she crying when I get back here? And then he's got to hold her down.
God.
Well, dude, a little common sense here.
It's so hard to watch. And then it's kind of hard to come back from that and get back into this mode of the movie where it's still almost the same day. You know, it's the following morning, but he hasn't slept, to just transition to this mode where they make up and they're friends. But I really want him to have that growth. And I love that that's his arc. It's not that his arc is to become a good dancer. Oh my God, you know what this movie's totally missing? Is it doesn't really have a montage. There's no, like, we're getting good at dancing montage. Because they don't really get that good at dancing. They just kind of stay where they are. They get to know each other. But there's no, we're going to win this contest montage. And they don't. I mean, they win the contest, but they're not the best dancers. And that's not his arc. His arc is to get out of this mindset of being one of these bro-y assholes like his dick friends and moving on, becoming a nice person and not letting his environment turn him into an asshole like his father. So I liked the ending intellectually, but I found it hard to be emotionally invested in him at that point in the movie.
Let's talk real. If you knew somebody and they said to you, I did what Tony did, I went as far as he did and started raping somebody, no penetration happened, she wasn't actually assaulted, but I was going down that road. And then for whatever reason, I stopped. And then I apologized to her, tried to make friends with her. Could you forgive that guy?
Yeah, probably. I believe that in remorse, there's some great threads on the internet of men who anonymously have admitted to committing rape and feel terrible about it. And they were in the mindset maybe of a culture that made them feel like they had permission to do it, or maybe they were drunk or young or just fucking idiots. I'm sure some of them are putting it on, but I'm sure some of them feel remorse too. People make mistakes. Maybe it would be in some cases helpful to the victim to have her perpetrator say, that was all me, I did that, I'm an asshole, none of it is your fault, you were a victim. You acknowledge that they did something wrong. Maybe that could be helpful and therapeutic. And I'm not a rape victim. I could never speak to how they could or should react and whether they could or should forgive their perpetrators. But I bet a lot of them have, especially because it's so common for your rapist to be someone you know.
So I think this movie is saying that he is being contrite at the end because you got to cut that slack.
And in between the attempted rape and him seeing her, one of his good friends have died, although I'm not sure how good friends they were. They seem to treat Poppy C pretty bad. Well, he doesn't fit in with them at all. He wants to be friends with them just because they're the cool kids, but I think they only let him hang out because he had a car.
He was the driver, yeah. That's also an authentic touch that happens all the time. Somebody who's got a car will be in the group but doesn't otherwise belong, she or he. All right, well, the cast, it's a shitload of newcomers in this cast. It was only Travolta's third movie. Of course, Carrie was one of the ones before that. We've covered that. We've covered Pulp Fiction. Is he the disco heir apparent to Gene Kelly? Because he's up there, I think, one of the great dancers in the history of movies.
Nobody's as good as Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire. No one's ever taken up
different
that
kind
mantle.
Of dancing, though, too.
Yeah, I don't think he's that good of a dancer. I think he's fun to watch, but I don't know. There's nothing about his dancing that blows me away. What skill and all the training it must have taken for him to get to this level of dancing. No, but he's very talented and very fun to watch.
I'd like to see him try to do some of the stuff with those guys, so they do the tap dancing and that kind of stuff, because he probably could have pulled it off. He seems to have that kind of grace and ability. The one thing from the opening that he hates, apparently, with the staying alive, is one of the very first shots in the montage of him, but it's not him, when he compares his boot or shoe, I guess it's a boot anyway, to a boot in a shoe store, and he's pissed about that because that was a body double. And he's mad because the guy who was doubling him had no sense of rhythm. He was also mad that they did a thing in the scene where he has the solo early on, and he wanted to make it very clear, just like Fred Astaire did, and maybe even Gene Kelly, but Astaire I know for sure was big on this, have it be a one-er so you can tell it's him. He learned all these steps for months. He doesn't want it to be that people would imply, well, that wasn't really John Travolta, the guy from Welcome Back, Carter, Mr. Cocktail. He wanted to make sure it was. So he had clashes with John Badham on this film, just like John G. Avildsen, who had directed Rocky, was originally the director of this and got fired. I'm not accusing Travolta of being a power play actor and a movie star, but it sounds like he got Avildsen fired, and it sounds like the problems were from his end more than Badham's end. So he was being all Johns, ironically. Yeah, all three of them are Johns.
Well, it's not a heavily edited scene.
Well, in the end, because apparently he got to pull rank. I've heard Tom Cruise from way back when Cruise was just becoming a star would be in the editing room. That is very unusual unless you're the director. Maybe if you're the producer, and Cruise has been the producer more in the last 20 years, but in the early days before he was an actual producer, he was allowed in there to shape the scene, which seems very unusual. And it sounds like Travolta was allowed, at least in some instances, in Saturday Night Fever to do the same thing. But he's a stuck-in-a-rut guy who's only alive when he's dancing. We've made that clear. I like the comparison, though, to Breaking Bad. In the finale of Breaking Bad, Walter finally admits to his wife, I was alive when he was making meth. And I know that's a weird comparison, but the only time this guy's alive is when he's dancing. Otherwise, he's going through the motions. Although it seems like he might be good as a paint salesman or hardware store owner if he ever got to that point.
He has no passion for
it. But he doesn't really want to do that, it's true.
There's a great scene when his boss, who seems like a genuinely nice guy, who likes him and respects him, is saying, oh, look at this guy, he's worked here for 10 years. Look at this guy, he's worked here for 15 years.
That's when he's out.
I could be a middle-aged man still selling paint for a living.
I can relate to that.
I know, like, you have a story just like that about the moment the boss was like, I see future here for you.
I've had two full-time jobs as an adult. The one I've had at the CBC since 98, the one I had before that. Probably could have gone far, worked your whole life doing that job. But it wasn't for me. And at a Christmas party, my boss and I got talking about this, and he said, oh, you're going to go far on this. I could see great things for you. And it scared the living shit out of me.
A wake-up call.
He went to the washroom, and I fucking bolted. Wow. And I remember thinking as I walked home, and I eventually got a cab, I thought, I'm out of here. And I wasn't. It took a few months before I actually was gone. But I can relate to that Travolta scene where it's, holy shit, this is now real. This guy's basically saying, this is your future. I was probably about Travolta's character's age at this point, too. No thanks.
Yeah, I like that moment. I caught it because you've told me that story before, and that's always made an impression on me.
All right, but back to the movie again. So Travolta was a huge star because of Walking Back, Carter. He's got charisma out the ass. But one of the unfortunate things about this production is that his girlfriend, Diana Hyland, died during production.
What?
That had to be tough, that he lost his woman. She apparently was a lot older than him, too. So he had to go through the grieving process. They shut down production, or just worked without him, at least, for a few days until he came back.
What happened to her?
I didn't hear, but that's on the making of, that she died. Maybe cancer or something like that.
Kind of reminds me of Deer Hunter.
Yeah, Meryl Streep and John Cazale, although he lived through the production, or at least the scenes that he was in. All right, well, Karen Lee Gorney, who does play Stephanie, she didn't do another movie for 14 years. And she became an acting and dancing teacher in the meantime. But that's also true of Donna Pescow, who plays Annette. This was her debut. She gained a ton of weight to play the character and also put on a Brooklyn accent. She's only ever been in three movies. She's done a lot of TV, at least. But that's kind of the theme of this movie, because Barry Miller plays Bobby C. Mostly has done TV. He was in The Last Temptation of Christ, but not a lot of other performances. But here's an actress we've seen before, Julie Bavasso. She's the mother. She was in Staying Alive, but she was one of the characters in Moonstruck.
Which I pointed out to you. Mm. I have the advantage because I've seen Moonstruck 1,000,000 times.
I had to look it up and thought, yeah, she's right. She is the aunt, I guess.
She's in yeah, she's Rose's sister-in-law.
And look for Fran Drescher as the ass grabber. They dance early on in the film, and she does that unscripted grab of his buttocks. I'll
tell you, women in Brooklyn in the 70s came on strong.
That's true, between her and Annette.
He proves playing hard to get is what wins over guys like that, because the only woman he's remotely interested in is Stephanie, who doesn't want anything to do with him.
What's the one he can't have? Well, their director is John Badham, who did Blue Thunder and War Games, lots of TV. Never made a truly great movie. This is probably the closest he's ever come. His writer was Norman Wexler, who did write Serpico, I mentioned that a few minutes ago, the poster on the wall, and the sequel Staying Alive. He based it on Nick Cohn's Tribal Rights of the News Saturday Night, which was an article in some magazine, New Yorker or something like that, which apparently was fantasy. There was never any kind of disco craze, at this level at least. Although disco was big in the 70s, but it was already dying out around the time of this movie.
Yeah, I read the story about it, and it seemed like he kind of faked his way into getting the job writing about the disco scene. He had just moved to New York from the UK, and he had no idea what he was getting himself into. He got to the club to do his research. Somebody threw up on his pants right outside the door, didn't even make it in, and then just turned around, left, and said to hell with it, and made the whole story up out of his imagination, based it on like people he knew from back home.
Well, it's not a documentary, so who cares?
No, no, exactly, who cares? But it's not as authentic, I suppose, of the disco scene as maybe some people think it was.
Robert Stigwood was the producer, big musical guy, Jesus Christ Superstar, Grease the next year, which we'll talk again, and the sequel, Staying Alive. So he's done a lot of musical films in his career, at least did back then. It's a pretty good resume. Technically speaking, the movie's 1.85:1, the DVD looked pretty clear and classy. The cinematographer was Ralph Bode, did Coal Miner's Daughter and Dressed to Kill around that same era. The editor, David Rollins, The China Syndrome, and Urban Cowboy with John Travolta. And the music was Barry Maurice and Robin Gibb, the Gibb Brothers. The non-disco music in the film is by David Shire, but that is probably the most famous part of the film, apart from the point and the strut at the beginning of the film, would be the soundtrack, which, yeah, as we said, really was a monster hit. We have failed
to talk about probably one of the most important things about the film, which is this soundtrack. It really made stars of the Bee Gees, and these songs are still completely iconic. They still get played at weddings.
This movie also, of course, put Travolta on the map and set him up for even bigger musical success in Grease, which was an even far bigger hit, actually, than this was, and it was a monster hit in its own right. But one of the other influences, apart from Staying Alive, the sequel, would be 8 Mile. Very similar arc, in fact. Another pseudo-musical, but it's really not a musical. It's a gritty drama. Also, some very controversial subject matter. A lot of bad language. But a guy who gets away from his bullshit job to do something he's good at, but is probably never actually going to have that as a long-term success.
Yeah,
even though the sequel to this movie implies that he does get somewhere in Staying Alive, he gets somewhere with his dancing talent. But in 8 Mile, at the end, he does the rap battle and he wins it. But if you remember that movie, he goes back to work.
Yeah.
He asked a guy to cover for him just for a little while. It wasn't like, I'm going to quit my job. No, can you just cover for me while I go do the rap battle? They say, hey, Rabbit, you were awesome. Okay, see you guys. I love that touch. As a shift worker, the idea that you just buy time sometimes to do things you want to do and then you have to trundle off to work. I play softball. I've had many times where I've played a game and then immediately gone to work afterwards.
And he's also has a pretty terrible home life with a mom that's
even
cruel
more so
to him.
In 8 Mile.
Yeah.
All right, the awards and list section is a little bit longer. We've had some of the movies we've covered so far this year. It was nominated for Best Actor for Travolta, but he didn't win. That went to Richard Dreyfuss in The Goodbye Girl. I think a pretty worthy nomination. Different kind of performance. Stood out a lot that year. Richard Burton was nominated for Equus. All these interesting actors. Different kinds of performances, different kind of actors in that year. The film is in the National Film Registry, so Congress is preserving it until the Orange Goblin decides to destroy Congress and destroy films in there, probably. It was put in there in 2010, the same year as All the President's Men, The Empire Strikes Back, and The Exorcist. I love that foursome. And of course, there were 21 more films that went in that year, 25 in total. Staying Alive was 9th on the top 100 songs list, which is a great song. But I ask, does it suit the movie?
I'm going to say yes.
What has Staying Alive got to do with this movie?
This song, it like embodies disco music, and he's keeping his life. Come on!
He's got the strut. Well, I don't want to make too big an issue about that. I just thought that was an interesting point. Staying Alive is not really what he's doing, but okay, fine.
They just probably picked it because it had the best beat, because it was the most catchy song, and they wanted that to be the title song.
Well, there's one thing you'll find online. A lot of the music they danced to wasn't what it became later on. It was a whole different thing, and then the Bee Gees music became the soundtrack that wasn't originally in the movie.
Lucky that the beats lined up.
Yeah, well, obviously it was planned out, I would think, maybe. I don't know.
There was one song that was written to accommodate a song they couldn't get the rights to, and when he's practicing with Stephanie in the dance studio, they had a song that they picked, and then they couldn't get it, so they got a composer to write something that had the similar beat, but also the same, I guess, bridges and crescendos, I suppose.
The movie was nominated for the Top 100 Cheers, I said that before, and also the Top 100 songs, along with Staying Alive, but this one didn't make it. It was More Than a Woman, More Than a Woman to Me. That's as good as I'm going to get. All right, well, last thoughts on our 200th podcast, Saturday Night Fever.
You know, I really liked it. It's so much smarter and more sophisticated than anyone gives it credit for, and I'm so glad I finally watched it. Oh, you know what occurred to me? You mentioned at the beginning that the Rotten Tomato numbers are really inconsistent, and I had this impression of this movie as a much cleaner, friendlier movie. The studio, 2 years after the movie came out, released a PG version where they cut out a lot of the grittier stuff, certainly the grittier language, the nudity and the sex scenes and the rape scenes. There was some stuff that was implied, but a lot of stuff was just left out altogether. They made a lot of money on that release theatrically, but anybody who would have seen this for the first time on television or only ever seen this on television has only ever seen the PG-rated version of it. So it's possible that taking those elements out makes it just a crummier movie, and that's why it has inconsistent ratings.
It's fucking bullshit.
Definitely, if you're going to watch the movie, watch the R-rated version. Don't waste your time with anything but the real deal. Right. It has a vision. That's very important that it be as gritty as it is.
Always true, though. There's never going to be a movie you're going to prefer to see in the censored version.
Yeah, some movies it doesn't matter so much when you're just taking out a few F-bombs or something, covering up a boob. This movie wouldn't be worth watching anything but the
We've covered at least four movies now in 1977. I think only four movies, actually. Three on the Top 100 Project. Star Wars, Annie Hall, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and now this. What a diverse foursome. Two of them set in New York, but they have nothing in common except for the fact that most people in the movie, both Annie Hall and this, are white. But other than that, these four movies are very different, and this is by far the most realistic and gritty.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
And that surprises a lot of people. I don't think they're going to think that Saturday Night Fever is going to be as realistic and gritty as it is. And I think kudos for that.
Yeah, in pop culture, it seems silly. When I grew up, I had a record called Sesame Street Fever, where Muppets sang disco music.
They probably saw the PG version on TV.
Yes.
All right, well, the next 100 Project reconvenes on March 27th. We'll tackle some life and death stuff in Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal. All right, here's the coming attraction trivia, and this one is a lot more elaborate than most. Name at least one of the movies Max von Sydow was in that were directed by the following legends: Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, Woody Allen, David Lynch, Ridley Scott, John Huston, and George Stevens. He's also been in a Star Wars movie, a Bond movie, and a modern television juggernaut. Name those as well.
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about the Seventh Seal. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and 07 lists of the best American films ever made. Every episode is available for free. And while you're there, rate us and review us, because it helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieTheme51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
This podcast was so weird.
And cut.
He hits it. He hits my hair.